So let's notice that we're still alive. And of course, we joke and say, yes, so. Well, that proves that we have this deep primordial assumption in our mind that somehow we're permanent. Of course, we don't analyze it like that, but that's exactly the analysis. That's Buddha's point. We have no sense of cause and effect, no sense of impermanent. It's one of the many misconceptions deep in the bones of our being. So how do you counteract these assumptions? You start with a concept that counteracts it. So the correct view, the scientific view, is that we're impermanent. It's a fact. We will die. Fact. So we get used to it. So we think, amazing, I'm still alive, which means our petrol tank of non-killing morality karma hasn't run out yet. How amazing. So I must not waste today. That's why for this reason we're sitting here, listening to these teachings, Buddha's views about reality, so that we can internalize them, make them our reality. And why? Not just to pass your philosophy exam, but to stop suffering. That's Buddha's method. So we think we're going to listen to these teachings so we can develop our amazing potential, so we can be of benefit to others, all the way to leading them to Buddhahood. This motivation is expressed in the second part of this prayer. And the first part of the prayer is just for those of us who are already Buddhist, who are reminding us, reiterating our reliance on the Buddha and his teachings. And this prayer is on page, what was it, 99 or something? Tell them. Okay. Yeah. Okay. If you want to join in. Otherwise, just, yeah. You don't have to. Sangye chadang soke chognam la jang chu badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chun yen gi personam ki drola penchir sangye drupa shog sangye chadang soke chognam la jang chu badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chun yen gi personam ki drola penchir sangye drupa shog Sangye charang soke chognam la Changshu badu dagni kyab su chi Dagi chonyen gi personam ki Drola penchir sangye drupa shok. So what we've done is a summary so far. Starting, so powerful, so focused, starting with the word Buddha and what the meaning implies. You know, once we understand this, it tells us the job to be done. It's very simple. Buddha, Sangye, the Tibetan equivalent. The etymology, as I said, is so tasty. The first syllable implies the utter eradication from our own being, our consciousness, our mind, all fear, all ego, all nonsense, all separate, all sense of loneliness and misery and unhappy and all the rubbish. The stuff that we are so familiar with, that we think in our world, in our neuroscience, in our psychology, in our own minds, we think is normal. So normal that we think you'd be weird if you didn't have it, you know. But this is Buddha's outrageous point. So some religious idea, so some fantasy in the sky, so, sort of some mysterious alternative to heaven. It's literally it's the capacity of our own mind. The second syllable, not only can we get rid of the rubbish, the second syllable implies we can develop all the other stuff in our mind, love, wisdom, compassion, etc., to perfection, literally. This is Buddha's finding. This is Buddha's experiential finding. So therefore, what's the job? Clear. You have to distinguish between the rubbish and the good stuff. That's it. That's it. It's almost too simple, the concept. But when we looked in the package yesterday, this Buddhist package, this lam rim, this Tibetan way of packaging Buddha's teachings in this incremental, gradual, experiential way, this is high school. This is the essence of the job. This is the heart of being a Buddhist. When you start to work on your mind, you're being a Buddhist. Just because you wear robes, just because you say prayers, just because you prostrate, it doesn't mean you're a Buddhist yet. Until you start changing your mind. That's the bottom line. That is the bottom line. And that's the hardest job we'll ever do, you know. So before we do that, which is the actual job, we've got lots of work we've got to do already before that to prepare our minds, to enable us to do it. That's junior school. That's the first scope. Now, that's what we learn about karma, you know. This is this fundamental view, the Buddha's view of the universe, the Buddha view of how the world runs, what the world is, what are sentient beings, what is happiness, what is suffering, what are the possibilities. This is Buddha's view of karma, you know. Many people like Buddhism. They like to go to high school and learn some mindfulness. There's nothing wrong with that. No one says you can't. But that's not the, you know, until if you want the big picture, you've got to hear about karma first. Of course, this is the one that's hard for us in our culture. Some people are embarrassed to talk about even your idea that your mind came from before, because, you know, it's such a silly idea for materialists. But let's look at it. It's the fundamental view. It's the big picture. We have to understand it. And again, all of this is in reference to our ability to do the real job, which is the text we want to get into, which we will, this outrageous practice of being able to transform problems into happiness. This is the background. This is the framework. This is the root. This is the foundation. This gives us the logic of why and how to do it. So Buddha's deal is there are trillions upon trillions of sentient beings, mind possessors. The Tibetan word is very delicious. Semchen, mind possessor. There are trillions. Humans are like a tiny percentage. Then we've got animals. We can see all those, and we know there's a lot of them. I mean, you probably have 7 billion mosquitoes under one tree here in one day in the summer. Well, there are 7 billion humans, so it's, you know, not a very big number. And they're all mind possessors. So these consciousnesses, as we discussed yesterday, as we said briefly, you know, the usual view we have is either we're made by mummy and daddy and our mind is the brain. We track our past back to mummy, daddy, grandma, grandpa, back to the monkeys. Or we have a view of a creator, that our source is God. Mummy and daddy give us the body, that's clear, but God gives us our essence, our soul, our spirit. Well, Buddha has neither of those. He agrees, of course, clearly, the body comes from parents, no problem, that's clear. But there's no concept of a creator, no concept of a soul or a spirit. He uses the word mind, the word consciousness. And as I said before, that refers to all our intellect, all the brilliant thoughts, all the feelings and emotions, unconscious, subconscious, instinct, intuition, this entire spectrum of our inner being. Buddha uses the word mind to cover all of this, which, of course, differs. So this differs from the Catholic the Christian teachings. There's no aspect that's different called soul, and it differs from the materialist view that, you know, mostly we use the word mind up for the intellect. You know, then we have emotions, like two separate parts of us, you know. The subtler levels of mind that Buddha asserts exist, which the Hindus first identified by developing this incredibly sophisticated psychological skill that the world knows vaguely as mindfulness, which is known more literally as shamatha or calm abiding, this brilliant skill that enables us to get single-pointed concentration at a very subtle level of our mind that we don't even posit as existing in our culture. So these are the things we have to comprehend, you know, at least intellectually, if we want to understand Buddhism intellectually. Forget about practice. And again, remember continually, where did this information come from? You know, it's not a question of being belief. The commonest question we ask, do I have to believe in reincarnation? Do you believe in this? Do you believe in that? That's how we talk in religion. We don't say, do I believe in mathematics? Do I have to believe in botany? No, you have to learn it. It's a very big difference. But because we have these very deep assumptions about spiritual teachings, that they can't be proved, that they're from on high, that they're revelation, that they're mysterious, this is not the way Buddhism thinks. And we're so used to thinking this way. So to remind ourselves all the time, you know. This is coming from Buddha's direct experience and has been proved by countless beings since the Buddha. And the literature is all there. Their findings are all there. And it's up to us, if we want to look into it, to prove it for ourselves by practicing it. So this mind, trillions of minds. So the mind for the Buddha that does not come from a creator, does not come from mummy and daddy. Brain, no problem. That's not your mind, baby. The way I like to put it is the brain and all the physical things are like these indicators, the genes, the DNA, all that stuff. They are real and they're physical indicators of what is happening in the mind and past karma. That's the way to say it, I'd say. So there's no contradiction. It's just a different way of presenting. So this mind of ours, not physical, doesn't come from mummy, daddy, doesn't come from a creator. So if at the first second of conception, when this package began, then the question has to be, well, what was the source of my mind? If it's not God, and if it's not mummy and daddy, and if it's not the physical, it can't come from nothing. That's evident. Nothing can come out of nothing. So what is the source of this, of that moment of my consciousness joining the egg and sperm at that moment? Well, it's a previous moment of that consciousness. And that is tracked back in an unbroken chain of mental moments, not more than a few weeks before that. And it was in another body, and so on and so forth. It's all covered in depth in all the literature for several thousand years. The Hindus came up with this as well. They saw this as well. So, the way to understand karma is very simply the way it's presented here as a basis for practice. The very first level of practice, as Lama Zopa says, the most urgent level of practice, entry level, junior school, grade one, the most immediate level of practice, is abide by the laws of karma at the very first level. So why? What's the logic here? Well, Buddha's saying basically, his simple point is that every millisecond of whatever arises in the mind of a being and in their life, whether you're an ant or a monkey or a human, and indeed whether you're another kind of being that doesn't have a physical body, many other kinds of beings we can't see, that have physical energy but more subtle, all these sentient beings. Every millisecond of whatever arises in our mind and in our lives is necessarily first the fruit of seeds planted in that mind in the past. And therefore, naturally, every millisecond of what I think and do and say now just naturally sows seeds in this consciousness of mine that eventually will produce the fruits in the future, which is my future experiences. This is not a very difficult concept. Intellectually not complicated. It's quite simple. Whatever I experience now, main cause, seeds planted in my mind from past actions. Whatever I do now, think now, say now, sow seeds that will produce my future experiences. In other words, everything we think and do and say programs us. Buddha would have liked that concept. We get this very easily when it comes to all the other, all our ability to play music, our ability to be a scientist or a mathematician. We get this completely. We recognize when we're learning music, every millisecond of what I think and do in relation to music produces the musician I become. It's hardly rocket science. We get that when it comes to all our bodies of knowledge, when it comes to learning things intellectually or, you know, or creatively. You have to learn skills and you must be accurate in those skills. You can't just think what you like if you want to play Bach. Oh, I can think what I like. You can, but it won't be Bach, baby. You have to abide by the laws of Bach's music, his theories. And you learn them rigorously with discipline and you practice them and eventually you play the piano. It's really not complicated. Well, that's how Buddha thinks about morality and all the stuff that we call our emotions. We get this law when it comes to up here, but to come here, we have a whole different set of laws. It's very curious. In other words, as Lama Zopa says, this is very shocking, the vast majority of all humans on this planet have absolutely no idea that what goes on in their mind when it comes to emotions, feelings, unhappy, happy, all this stuff. We have no idea that what goes on in our mind plays any role at all in our lives. Now, when it comes to music, you know absolutely everything that goes on in your mind when it comes to music is what produces the musician. That we are clear. You, every second of what you know about mathematics, which is in your mind, impacts upon and informs how you practice math. This is so obvious. But when it comes to emotions, we've got a completely other, very bizarre load of nonsense in our heads. It's very, very strange how we think. For Buddha's view, whether you practice piano or practice anger, same. It produces results in you. Hardly should be surprising to us. But we're so shocked by that. If you practice love or practice killing, same. You turn yourself into a really loving person or a really good killing person. It's not really a complicated concept, but we don't get it when it comes to emotions and stuff. It's very fascinating. The Buddha is saying very simply, whatever we think and do and say is the main cause of what I become. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, karma is like self-creation. It's a really simple way to put it, but it's a very shocking idea to us. Because we are convinced that somehow we're this innocent victim of somebody else's handiwork. You know, okay, we like God, happy to have God make us. But mummy and daddy, how dare they be naughty people and ridiculous people and make me? Who do they think they are? We're very shocked and outraged. That's the view we have. You know, they made us. And I'm this innocent victim that got plonked on this planet And then it's all good luck and bad luck. I mean, this is beyond idiocy, beyond stupidity. But we think it. We believe it. We even believe it scientifically. Well, no one knows, we'll say. Well, Buddha's got his presentation. So the general point about karma, this is the principle that runs the universe, because this applies to all sentient beings. And Buddha's view of the mind, which we'll go into more detail when we get to high school again, this also applies to all sentient beings, all the dogs and monkeys and ants and hell beings and spirits and gods and humans. Buddha's view of the mind, his model of the mind, Buddha's psychology, is referring to all of them. It describes the entire universe. It's a holistic view that describes every being, every ant, every hell being, every human. It's very fascinating. So in general, every millisecond, whatever arises in the mind of any being, and everything we think and do and say, this is the principle that this is the law of karma, and it's a natural law. This is something, again, to remember repeatedly, because we're so used to thinking of it as religion, therefore we think of it as revelation, therefore we think we have to believe it, and therefore we think of it as punishment and reward. You listen to this. It's very fascinating. So I have a Jesuit priest friend, and I asked him, what is a sin by definition? What defines something as a sin? What makes an action a sin? He said, what defines something as a sin is that it's against God's will. That whatever if you do what God said not to do, that is what a sin is. He said there's some aspect of natural law, like killing, for example. You know, they agree that killing, people don't like getting killed. That's natural law. But what makes it, what defines it as wrong, this is a really powerful point. And I think we think like this automatically, but we don't spell it out, you know. So naturally, if there is a being called God who does create the universe, then great, that's a totally perfect law. It makes sense, he is the boss. That means he has the power to punish and reward. That is clear. But in Buddhism, there's no such thing. The word superior being, Buddha uses that. But he says everybody can become one. That's his big difference, you know. But the idea of there being somebody who runs the show, you know, who therefore punishes and rewards, there is no punisher or rewarder in Buddhism. But when we hear karma, we hear it like that. That's our mistake. Because we have already this dualistic view of punishment and reward. It's in our world as well. I mean, in our mother's household. When you're a little girl and she says, don't do that. And you say, why not? We know her answer. Same as God's. Because I say so. And we live like that all our lives. The government says, don't do this. The police, the judge, auntie, grandma, grandpa. We live like this. We have this idea, therefore, we have this idea that if no one sees me do a naughty thing, then in English we say, oh, I got away with it. Well, this for Buddha is like going to the doctor. And she says, Rini, you mustn't smoke. Why not? Because you'll get cancer. You don't say, how dare you say you're going to punish me with cancer? Who do you think you are? No, she's not saying that. She's being a kind, wise, you know, advisor, giving you advice based on her experience. So there are dire consequences of you smoking. You will suffer, honey. So then equally, you don't go home and notice your doctor's not there, and out come the Marlboros. Oh, I won't get cancer. My doctor doesn't see me. We would be thought an idiot if we thought that. But that is how we live our lives. That's what we think about morality. We're really, it's like infantile. And this is, don't blame your Jewish mummy or your Catholic mummy for this. This is the function of ego grasping. This is the function of ignorance. Buddha's view, this dualistic nonsense that we have created, that creates you and me, that creates all this dualistic idea of good and bad and punishment and reward. We've made all that up, you know. It comes from ego grasping. It's already in our mind, so it's very deep. And karma is based in this logical view of dependent arising. So we've got to think about this. So for Buddha, then, what is a sin, a negative action? How do you define it for the Buddha? It's a natural law, he says. Check around. Who likes being killed, lied to, stolen from? Nobody. That's what makes it negative. Nothing to do with Buddha. Same as the doctor. Nothing to do with her that smoking gives you cancer. She simply observed it. She's intelligent. Well, Buddha is intelligent. He's observed that negative actions, and this is what we're going to look at, actions driven by an erotic state of mind. This is the analysis of it, and we have to understand this so we can grow up and take responsibility and use this as the basis of our practice if we say we're Buddhists. I mean, no one's forcing us. We've got to unpack these ideas, not just repeat them blindly. So Buddha's saying, in general, every millisecond of what we think and do and say sows seeds in our mind that will produce fruits. No choice. It's the natural law. It's the way it is. No one's running this law. Buddha didn't make it up. It's not punishment. It's not reward. There is no punisher. There is no rewarder. We do it to ourselves. We are the creators. The next level of detail, and this is the crucial one, this is what we learn in junior school, and this becomes the basis of our first level of practice. And this is taking this whole view, like we said yesterday, one way of just, it's the most natural one in the universe, this whole view, as Buddha says, everyone wants to be happy, everyone doesn't want to suffer. Well, all this view of the Four Noble Truths, all this understanding of karma is based on this fundamental principle. And it's Buddha's method of how to get happy and how to stop suffering. He says our methods are ridiculous. They do the opposite. So it's all about suffering and happiness. It's framed in that way. So the next level of detail is every millisecond of what we think and do and say that we can label as a negative action, and it's very nuanced and there's a lot of detail, but here it's just a general idea, just we're being fairly general here, will necessarily ripen in the future as my suffering. Every millisecond of what I think and do and say that's labeled positive or virtuous in general will necessarily sow seeds in my mind that will ripen in the future as my happiness. This is the principle. Like I said, not punishment, not reward. There's no punisher, there's no rewarder. It's a natural law, like botany. You sow a seed, it'll bring a fruit, whether you like it or not. We don't have a panic attack about that. We have a panic attack about this, because we have these misconceptions that someone's out there trying to get us. It's like a conspiracy theory, you know? A creator idea is like a conspiracy theory. I hope you don't. If you have faith in God, don't think I'm being rude. Excuse me. Faith in a creator, you know. We're the boss. We're the boss. I don't know how we can't like that. I think it's the best idea I've ever heard. I love being the boss. I mean it sincerely. The other view is just like this victim. I mean, who wants to live in fear and misery and think everyone's trying to get you? I mean, no wonder we're depressed and unhappy, you know, and paralyzed. Buddha says we are the boss. So if every millisecond of what I think and do and say that's labeled negative brings suffering, and even if we just look at the first level of suffering, like I said yesterday, Buddha says there are three levels in the Four Noble Truths. Let's just look at the first one, the suffering of suffering, the suffering of pain, which is when the bad things happen. Forget about the different realms of existence. Just look into this life. Everybody, we all know we don't like, you know, having illness. We don't like pains in our knees. We don't like people being mean to us. Very simple, 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 simple concept. Nobody wants this. This is called suffering. Simple level, first level. Everybody, monkeys don't like it, ants don't like it, dogs don't like it. It's automatic, it's profoundly obvious. So Buddha says he's got a method to get rid of this. So clearly you've got to know first what the suffering is. Suffering of pain is when the bad things happen. That's first noble truth, first kind of suffering of the three. Second, what are the causes? Because if you want to solve a problem, you've got to first identify the name of the problem and then you have to identify the causes. When you've identified the causes, you have the solution implied. So what are the causes? I did have a boyfriend, but one day he's gone. He's not. I have to have another boyfriend. He's a man. Oh, he must. What? I know. He's there. I know. He mightn't be there all the time. Who's? I'll use this man over here. You're my boyfriend. What's your name? Huh?
Ron.
What?
Ron.
Ron.
Yes.
R-O-N. Yes. It sounds very Australian. What's it? Oh, you're Dutch?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So Ron's my boyfriend, okay? These are so simple examples. It's sort of like we just joke, you know? But we can see how primordial this view is. So because we mentioned briefly, we began yesterday in high school talking about the mind, and we got the 84,000 delusions down to three. 84,000 neuroses, remember? Buddha subsumes them to three. And these three, the toxic emotions, are three poisons. Ego grasping, the root one, which gives rise to attachment, which gives rise to aversion. So because we have attachment and aversion, and I said began yesterday, and we'll talk more, This attachment runs the show. It's like the motor that drives everything we do and say, even when we're good. This is very depressing to hear this, you know. It's very shocking. Even all the good stuff we do is still polluted by, dragged down by attachment. How miraculous that we have any good tendencies. How marvelous. But when the attachment is there, that's what pollutes. And the more strong that is, the more miserable we are and the more we harm others. So attachment, like I said yesterday, we'll go into it more detail, but here with karma, driven by this dissatisfaction, this belief that when I find this gorgeous person out there, he will bring me happiness. Then he appears divine to me, and then I expect him to give me happiness. And all this is kind of like almost unspoken because it's so primordial. So there's poor Ron. He's the object of my attachment, you know. So why, then I'm crying. Why are you miserable, Rabina? Why are you suffering? Ron looked at the other girl or something. Just something simple, ordinary examples. So naturally for us, what is the main cause of my suffering? There's no question, it's called Ron. It's very simple. What's wrong? You're suffering. Oh, the lunch was horrible. What's wrong? You're suffering. It was very cold weather. Because we have this attachment, this primordial, I mean, Lama Yeshe says, I can tell you about it for a whole year. You won't begin to understand it. We have this cliched view about it. Oh, I like chocolate cake. I'm so attached. That's the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg. It's a primordial assumption in the mind, you know. For ancient, countless lives, Buddha says, we've practiced it to perfection. So all this attachment, as far as I'm concerned, there's one cause of my suffering. Well, the Buddha, as in the Second Noble Truth, there are two causes, two main causes. There are many, many, many causes. Ron is one of them. In fact, there are thousands of causes to produce anything. We know that. I mean, look at the number of things you've got to have just to produce a flower. But you can narrow it down to certain things. The seed is the main cause. There's one main cause of a flower. It's a seed. But it needs cooperative causes. It needs earth and water and time and a bit of warmth. You can hold a seed in the sky for 47 years. You won't get a flower. So the seed is the main cause, but you've got to have the secondary causes. So the Buddha identifies the two main causes of my suffering. It's a very technical point, but it's so horrific to us because we can't hear it. There are two main causes of my suffering, and neither is Ron. He's a secondary cause. He's like the soil or the water that enables the seed to ripen. So what's the seed? The seed is from an action, karma. The word karma means action, but it has this. But the actual meaning, even of action, is mental action, and that means intention. And when we discuss the mind later in more detail, intention is there every millisecond, driving everything we do. It's like one of the mechanics of the mind. Intention. I remember Alex Berzin, this American scholar, as he says, it's not so kind of rational. It's more like an urge because it's so deep in us, you know. So intention is the real meaning of karma. Mental action. That's what starts everything, and we'll go into this now. So, karma and delusion, two main causes, karma and neurotic state of mind, karma and disturbing emotion, karma and so-called affliction, these words we described yesterday. Two main causes, and they subsume to one, the mind, the neurotic state of mind. That's the root of it. That's the root even of an action. So, the two main causes of this moment of my suffering, one, past action that left a seed in my mind. It was an action driven by a neurotic state of mind. The action and then driven by a neurotic state of mind, driven by a mental affliction, driven by anger or attachment or something. Left a seed in my mind. And I didn't take care of the seed. I allowed it to grow. And now 2.5 lives later, the condition called this person called Ron, because karma's pretty personal, his presence and his action triggers that seed in my mind. The seed was in my mind. And it triggers it, and a moment of a suffering arises. That's it. It's very technical, very simple, not complicated, but it's like horrifying to us. You mean I'm the blame? Is the first way we answer. Shocked by that, you know. Well, yes. Because if I describe a moment of happiness, it's exactly the same logic. Why are you happy, Rabina? Oh, Ron's so kind to me. So, of course, in my mind, automatically there's one main cause of my happiness. It's called Ron. This is so clear to us. This philosophy, the belief in attachment, getting what it wants, is what drives the whole universe. And this is why we suffer, Buddha says. It's called samsara. We don't question it. It's automatic. We've learned it to be perfected in countless lives. And this is the gross level of attachment. This is the gross, heavy-duty, obvious level of attachment. As we get to the eight verses, as we get to the more advanced level, compassion wing, university, we start to look into, you know, these eight verses. And the seventh one, or the eighth one, the seventh one. Yeah, this is where we really look into a more advanced level of all this stuff, you know, much more primordial. And this whole idea of transforming problems is much more primordial level of understanding attachment. It's a way of giving up attachment at a subtler level. But we've got to understand the grosser one first, which is the sensory one, which is why at this first level, given that everything I think and do and say that's labeled negative will ripen as my suffering, and given that everything that I do that's virtuous will ripen as my happiness, and guess what? I want happiness and don't want suffering. It's hardly a no-brainer. Logical, first level, entry level, first level of practice, control your body and speech. Behave properly. Don't harm sentient beings, please. So Buddha lists a little list of 10 don'ts. The first 7 are about body and speech. And this, you know, when you first hear this, it just kind of sounds boring. Oh, I want to meditate, please. I thought I was a Buddhist. Well, if you can't control your body and speech, how the hell can you meditate? Don't be ridiculous. If you can't control what we do with this, if we can't control the servants of our mind, the body and speech, it's very simple, you know. How can you control the mind? It's literally impossible. But the sense of urgency here, and the way Lama Zopa puts it, the most urgent level of practice, given that everything we think and do and say just naturally will leave seeds in my mind and will ripen in the future as my suffering, if it's negative, then it's obvious my first level of practice is stop sowing more negative seeds. I mean, it's not complicated. Stop sowing more negative seeds, at least first, immediate. So what's that? At least don't kill. At least don't take the ungiven. Tibetan term for stealing. Don't take the ungiven. It's very blunt. 3, don't misuse your body based on sexual attachment. Jump on the wrong partner. You know, or as the Holiness says, rape and things like that, you know. In other words, don't do actions with our body that harm sentient beings. These are the obvious heavy-duty ones. I mean, if you start to list all the actions using our body that harm sentient beings, there must be hundreds and thousands of them. But Buddha just narrows it down to the heaviest ones at this first level. At least protect yourself. And this is the point about karma. We have to think this through. We have this automatic response when we hear someone say, don't harm others, be a nice person. Well, it's sort of, you're just supposed to do that, you know. And really, but what it is because we, you know, we want to be a good girl and don't want to be a bad girl. So we kind of do it because we think we'll get rewarded. Much of it's that. That's the deeper way attachment works, which we'll talk about later. You know, if you're a Christian, you will do it because God, you know, you will refrain because God said not to. That's good. That's at least good. But we never have a very logical reason for why we don't do. We just say, oh, well, it's natural not to want to kill. Well, I'm sorry. Look at the world. It's not natural. So we've got to have a logical reason why not kill. So there's 2 things here, and this is the point. 2 things at this level of practice. In general, the Buddha's saying a negative action at the heavier level is one that harms another. It's a natural law. It's got nothing to do with the fact that he says it. He's like the doctor who's observed that and this is the point now, it is a natural law, it does harm others. That's what defines it as negative. But the point is this. What is informing Buddha's advice to us at this level of practice, why he exhorts us not to do it at this level, isn't because it harms others. It's because it will harm me. This we find very hard to hear. Most people think, oh, that just sounds very selfish. You mean I shouldn't kill because it'll harm me? Oh, that sounds selfish. Well, you've got to have this level of practice first. We've got to understand, and this is the point about karma, everything I think and do and say is what produces me. So this first level of practice is to have this sense of urgency, a sense of self-respect, that I don't want future suffering. I'm up to here with suffering. We have to become familiar with that. That's what they mean by renunciation. We have to be revolted by the thought of more suffering. And if you can't, you know, and think of the simplest level of suffering. You don't want to get sick. You don't like being rejected. You don't like people lying to you. You don't want to be poor. You don't want to live in a war zone. You don't want to be tortured. You don't want to be raped. Think of the suffering, ordinary suffering of just humans. Forget animals. Forget, you know, forget other realms. It's evident nobody wants this. This is what we mean by suffering on this planet, when bad things happen to us. Nobody wants it. I don't. Even the smallest thing our mummy does to us, our boyfriend does to us, it is pain, you know. We don't want it. We've got to realize that in a stark way, you know, and then be sick of it. And then when we take on board Buddha's view about what causes it, of course it will be logical to find it unbearable to do a negative action. Not because you'll get punished, but because you are sick of suffering and you know you are the cause of it. This is profound. This is junior school. It's hard for us to hear this. People often say, oh, I have such compassion for other people, but I can't have compassion for myself. It's because you've missed junior school and high school. We rush off with all these emotional ideas of helping other people, and we crash to the ground because it's neurotic and ridiculous, and it's not based in stability. Because we haven't done junior school and high school. We haven't understood karma. We haven't understood suffering. We haven't understood the causes of it. We've got to rub our noses in this stuff. And that will energize us. That's the basis of practice. Then we can build a proper practice on top of that. Compassion wing and then tantra. If we can't do this, we can't understand tantra. Don't even pretend. If you can't understand high school attachment, you can't practice tantra. It's a joke. It's a complete joke. I don't care how many times you do your holy mantras and your visualizations. You have no idea what you're doing until you understand junior school and high school. We can't miss pieces of the practice. So if what I do with my body, driven by a neurotic state of mind such as anger or attachment, is what defines an action as negative, the heaviest level, like killing or sexual misconduct or stealing, let's analyze exactly how it all works. What's like the technology of this? You know, what are the components of a negative action? How is it that it makes it negative? Don't just believe Buddha. Don't just believe that he says it. Don't believe him. You know, that's not enough. That what you do brings results to you. Try to understand the logic of it. So if a negative action is one that's driven by a negative state of mind, and then I'd better know what the components of the action are when I do them. So there's four ways our karma ripens, four tracks of karma, if you like. And it's a way of describing our entire life. And when we can understand this, it's very profound. It helps us understand our actions. So the first way our karma ripened from the past is in the type of rebirth we get. So in our case, we're born a human. Okay, it's like we won the lottery. It's not good luck. It's not the lottery, but it's like that. The rarity of it is so incredible, apparently. And if we look at the number of creatures there are on the planet, just the non-humans, then it's fairly evident it's easier to get a human. It's easier to get a mosquito birth than to get a human birth. It's fairly obvious. So in that sense, it's immediately obvious it's rare because we're all sentient beings. We're all mind possessors, all driven by the law of karma, ants and dogs as well. So, okay, the first way is, so the cause, the main cause of getting a human body, the main cause of our mind finding its way to our mummy's, present mummy's fallopian tube is an action of virtue, of non-harming, in particular non-killing. In particular, practice, as Lama Zopa says, in the context of keeping vows, which we'll talk about. One of those seeds was triggered. Before we stop breathing, already our new life was programmed. At the same time, a second lot of karma, seeds would have been triggered. This is the second track of karma, and it's called, different terms, it's called, you know, you can call it intentions or actions similar to the cause. It's our tendencies, our personality traits, our habits. There's Hitler and there's Mother Teresa, both human. They both got a virtuous seed. There's four tracks of karma, four bank vaults, if you like. And each of them, at the time of their past death, one of their virtuous karmic seeds of non-killing was triggered, and they both got a human mummy. Second track of karma, now you can see the differences. Very clear, isn't it? The tendencies in their minds. Hitler's this maniac, you know, went off and harmed lots of people, and Mother Teresa, you know, tried to help lots of people. So clearly, lots of different tendencies in the mind. This is the second track of karma. Our tendencies, our personality traits, our habits. Very simple, our habits. Third track of karma, you have a look at this, we're very social beings, aren't we? Since we are born, we're connecting with others. We've got mummies and daddies and aunties and uncles and sisters and brothers and rats and cockroaches and ants and all the sentient beings that we meet in our life up until now. And if you think of it very simply, you can divide all those sentient beings into two groups. It's very simple. Those that help you and are kind to you and those that are harmful to you. And often they change roles. That is clear. There's a third category of sentient beings, all the strangers, and they do neither. So we don't even care about them. There are those sentient beings who harm us, and there are those sentient beings who are kind to us. This kind of karma, in other words, what happens to us, how we're seen and treated by others, this is called experiences similar to the cause. This one in here is called intentions or actions or habits similar to the cause. So you have a tendency to be kind because you were kind before. You have a tendency to lie because you lied before. You have a tendency to be generous because you were generous before. It's hardly rocket science. It's habit. You play the piano because you practiced it before. Now, this other one, and this is the source of much of our suffering, much of our pain, when bad things happen to us, equally when the good things happen to us. And because we've got this bottomless pit of attachment that only wants the nice things, that drives us, the millisecond Ron does something wrong to me, looks the wrong way, says the wrong word, you know, farts in the sheets instead of the toilet. You know, attachment doesn't get what it wants. That's called suffering. So we are frantic and we put this responsibility, do we not, onto the outside world. They had better do exactly what I want. The food, the people, the events, the weather. This is how we all are. So this is called experiences similar to the cause. And this is the one that is really the source of so much of our pain and suffering. And we don't understand. If I'm kind and loving to Ron, because that's my tendency, I have an assumption that he should be kind and loving back. But if he starts being mean to me and punching me in the nose, look at the suffering we have. We are so shocked. And the main reason we are shocked is because, but I didn't deserve it. I didn't do anything to deserve it, we say, which is logical. But except your framework's too small, that's all. Just because of this life. But that's how we have so much pain. Look at the world, the suffering. That's the suffering we have. Unbearable suffering when it's others who harm us. This is called experiences similar to the cause. So if karma is a natural law, no one made it up, then it's got to be coherent. It's fairly obvious. So you better learn it. It's not evident right now because we haven't learned it. But if it is a natural law, it's coherent. That's pretty shocking. So that means whatever arises in my life, in my mind or in my experiences, I must have planted it. It's my life. You know, botany is a great example. The lamas use it all the time. Buddha uses it. Seeds and fruits. So you look in your garden. You look in your garden. And you know it's your garden. And what's in there? You know that either you put it there or you didn't pull out what was there. That's how come you got weeds, and that's how come you have veggies and flowers. So you have a sense of ownership, don't you? So if it's there, you don't say, who put weeds in my garden? You never say that. They're your weeds. You own them. That's our life is our garden. It's such a great example. But this is like the opposite of how we feel, isn't it? And this is the view we have in the world. Someone else made me. Someone else made the planet. I had nothing to do with it. I'm just an innocent victim. No wonder we're all crazy. This view is kind of tasty, you know. I find it, at least, for me, I find this the most coherent view I've heard so far. I think the creative view is preferable, actually. The creative view, if you have it properly, it's a pretty profound view. You have faith in God, you know. Well, at least, I mean, if you have faith in God, at least God has a plan. With the materialist world, we haven't got a plan yet. We don't know. We're still looking. And that's okay. We're trying hard. I'm not being rude or anything, just trying to show the different viewpoints on the planet. At least if you have a view and a faith in a creator, there is a being who knows what's going on because he created the whole thing. So at least you can have faith in somebody. At least you can, well, God knows what's going on. At least someone knows. But if the other one, no one knows, we say, I don't want to live like that. And it's so nihilistic. No one knows. It's just luck, good luck. That's a monstrous view. That's a monstrous philosophy to have. No wonder we kill ourselves. Depression, you know. No one knows why. Just, it's terrible. Buddha's got this other view. Of course, it's a big one to think about. Got to hypothesize it first. We're not clairvoyant yet. We can't see we've got a mind that goes from before and goes after. We can't see that yet. But we take it as our hypothesis. So the fourth way our karma ripens is called environmental. This has got really abstract, but there's ways of understanding this when we understand the Vajrayana. You know, we'll go into this. It's very helpful. So using one example of one action, let's say a conscious, let's look into a conscious intentional action of non-killing. A conscious intentional action of non-killing. There are four results of that. The first one would be a human rebirth. The second one would be you're born with a tendency to not kill. Hardly complicated. Third, you won't get killed or die young. And fourth, the very physical world itself will nourish you and not harm you. That's the result of non-killing. So, you know, whatever you eat will nourish you. You're going to be healthy. You won't get sick. Whatever you eat and whatever you drink is delicious. Even if the environment's bad, it won't harm you. That's the result of non-killing environmentally. People won't kill you or you won't die young. That's the result of non-killing experience similar to the cause. You won't have a tendency to kill. That's the result of not, that's the intention similar to the cause. And you will have a human birth. That's the four results of non-killing. Now, if you look at the planet, we can see, look at the environmental suffering. I mean, more and more and more look at environmental suffering. This is the collective karma from eons ago of killing, that the environment harms us. Well, no, there's many negative actions. They all have their own way of ripening. But the one of where you get sick or the food harms you, the water's polluted, that's a particular one of non-killing. All the other negative actions have their own results. The second one, being killed or dying young. Look at the world. Look at just humans. Look at the number of beings who won the lottery and got a human body but got aborted. I mean, I had an abortion when I was 23. So that human being, that person, when they died, they karmically created the course to come to my human womb. They won the lottery. They got a human body. But they had the other karma from another life of killing, and so they got the experience similar to the cause of that seed of killing, and they died young and got killed. I aborted them. Look at the human planet, the number of beings who get aborted, dying young. Look at those who are miscarried, dying young. Look at the babies who die, one-year-olds who die, 15-year-olds who die with no medical cause. Karma ran out. The petrol tank ran out, basically. The main cause of everything is the past karma. The main cause for Buddha, technically, logically, every action ever in the universe, any moment of happiness, any moment of suffering, in the entire universe. The main cause, the karma and the state of mind of the person who experiences it. Buddha puts us completely in the center of responsibility of every tiny thing that ever happens to us. We caused it. We are the boss. So if an action that's called negative will ripen as future suffering, I'd better know the breakdown of a negative action. What are the components of a negative action? We have to know this. Don't just believe it blindly. That's superstition. So what are the main factors? Well, it's quite nuanced. We'll keep it simple. For an action to be called a complete action of killing, let's say, a complete action of killing, that will ripen as a fully ripened result, which is a type of rebirth. So if killing is a karma that is triggered before you stop breathing, that'll cause you to get born like in an animal realm or something like that, the main result. So the components of an action, a complete action, this is just a little bit of it, not a complete story. There are four components. The first is there has to be an object of the action, and obviously it's a living being. Well, that mouse in your kitchen, let's start with that. Well, start with my abortion, why not? So then, the first was there had to be a living being there. Well, interestingly, and I don't want to give too much information here, but this is an interesting point, and a lot of women tell me that they have this experience too. When you're in the action with the boy, you know you're pregnant. I don't know if anybody else knew that, but the second I was with this boy, I was a hippie in 1968 in London. No need for too much detail. Doesn't matter. I was 23. And I and this boy, or whoever, and I knew that second. I said to myself, in that action with the boy, oh no, I said to myself, I'm pregnant. Right there. A friend of mine, interesting, lately, a friend of mine, she said her daughter was staying with her. While her daughter was staying with her husband at their house, because their house was getting renovated or something. And the daughter came down for breakfast and said, oh, mummy, I'm pregnant. And the mother said, when did you know? She said, 40 minutes ago. Do you understand? You people, you don't laugh, you Italians. I thought you were meant to be volatile, funny people. I'm the one who's so volatile here. You're sitting there really quietly. Did you get what I said? You all understood? You in the green cardigan, the lady in the green cardigan. Did you get what I said? The green cardigan. The green cardigan. Here. This lady. This one. Good. Thank you. She smiled at me. Okay. Did you hear what I said? Did you all get what I said? I'm sorry. I didn't get any response from you. Thank you very much. She didn't get it. You didn't get what I said. What's your name, darling, in the green cardigan? Maura. Paola. Oh, you're Paola. Where was the other Paola? Another one. There's Paola. What I'm saying is, this is an incidental point, by the way. I find it interesting. It's just reiterating Buddha's point that conception is when we begin. The consciousness goes into the egg and sperm at the time of conception. That's all I'm trying to make. And this extra point I'm talking about here when it came to me getting pregnant, it's an extra point. And I recognized it the second I was with the boy, that I knew, in other words, I knew a consciousness just came into my egg, into my body. I didn't call it that then. So all I'm saying is that story about my friend's daughter. She, anyway, if you missed it, never mind, don't matter. I'm now laboring it too much. Forget it. So, okay, a complete action. In my case, abortion. This case. So there was a living being there. A consciousness had joined the egg and sperm in my fallopian tube. So I went and verified it with the doctors. And they said, yes, it's a fetus. So that's the first one. There was a living being there. It's a living being from the first second of conception. This is interesting. I remember some Jewish people told me that the Jews say that God doesn't put the soul there until a few months later. So for Jews, it's not a sin if you have an abortion because it's not a person yet. Whereas the Christians also say God puts the soul there at the time of conception. Well, the Buddhists say the consciousness goes there at the time of conception as well. You got the point. So it is a living being. It's a tiny living being, and it's not a viable living being, but it's still a living being. There's a consciousness there, and that's what defines a thing as being a living being, a mind possessor. So the first of these four components to show that the action I did was a complete action of killing, the first one was there was a living being there. Second, this is the crucial piece, my mind involved in this action. So that means there's two parts there. There's more to it, but we'll keep it simple. First is the intention. And this is not meaning good intention. This is meaning action. I will. Volition. Intention is I will. Volition. So I decided, even when I knew I was pregnant, I knew I would get an abortion, which means, putting it bluntly, I decided I would kill that fetus. I'm not trying to be romantic or, I mean, dramatic. I'm just speaking simple words. There was an intention in my mind, very clear. Now, the second part, and this is the interesting part, this is called the motivation. So mostly with abortions, women or men who agree to the abortion, we don't have an abortion because we hate the fetus. That's called anger, isn't it? That's called anger. I mean, if Ron is that horrible, I might want to kill Ron. That's called anger, not attachment, isn't it? But mostly a fetus is attachment. Attachment to what? Well, it's pretty obvious. Attachment, I'm not being mean here because life is complicated. Life is difficult. Life has many traumas and problems and conditions make life very difficult. But we've got to be very blunt and analytical here to analyze our role in these things, you know. So in my case, it's very clear. Well, not even that clear. I just know I didn't want a baby. It was very interesting. I just knew I didn't want a baby. I didn't feel violent or anguished about it. I just didn't want what would come out the other end. Very curious, actually, if I think about it. So it's called attachment to getting what I want. It's not what I wanted. So the way to get what you want is to get rid of the problem, isn't it? It's pretty obvious. So my motivation was attachment. It's pretty clear, straightforward. Attachment. Third component is the action itself. Okay, I didn't do it directly, but I went and asked the doctors and the nurses, and they did it. And that makes it heavier because I got other people involved in killing my baby for me. If you've had an abortion, if you've traumatized by it, please don't feel bad. And if you do feel bad, come and talk to me. I'm just trying to be direct and straightforward, analyzing things we do. So the third was the action, and I did that. In fact, I agreed. I went to the hospital, and they agreed, and I agreed, and I said to them, basically, please take the baby out. For the result, a dead baby. In this case, it died. You know, so that's a complete action of killing. And so, of course, every action of killing done by every sentient being, the four things can be there, but in every case there's going to be many other conditions that influence the action, whether it's a habit, how much the delusion was, a million variations. It's very nuanced. It's very subtle. But these are the fundamentals, you know. These are the fundamentals. Now, it's so clear. The point is this. Let's say I got pregnant, but I didn't know. I didn't know I got pregnant. I did something. Let's say I did it. Okay, this is going to be complicated, that one. Let's say, you know, you have an action. Let's say Paola has an action. She's got a mouse in her kitchen. And she's washing the dishes and making the salad and trying to look for, you know, looking after, cooking my lunch for me and being all very kind. And she's thinking about the salad and thinking about the lunch and she's laughing at my jokes while she's cooking. So, but there's an object there. There's a mouse. Second, her mind involved in it. No, she doesn't see the mouse. There's no intention to kill, and there's therefore no motivation. How can there be? If there's no intention, I will kill. There can't be a motivation. So the mind is completely missing. The second part is completely missing. But the third part is there. She puts a foot on the mouse. Fourth, dead mouse. Zero karma. Because karma first starts with the mind. That's what drives it. How can there be karma there? It's not possible. Karma has to be the mind involved, because karma leaves an imprint in the mind, and what leaves an imprint in the mind is the mind doing something. Her mind was cooking salad. Her mind was washing the dishes. Equally, if you're walking along the street and there's a homeless person, one object, homeless person. Two, intention to give 20 euros. No, no intention. Motivation, no motivation. You just don't even notice. Three, 20 euros falls out of your pocket. Four, person gets 20 euros. They're happy. For you, zero karma of generosity. Of course there's no karma, because your mind didn't decide to give 20 euros. But the thing is, we're doing actions every millisecond. There are intentions every millisecond. There's never a second there's no intention to do something. And the Buddha's saying most of it's just programmed and it's mostly driven by attachment. But there's lots of things we do where there's no intention to do it. There's no motivation to do it. Therefore, there's no karma of having done it. Mind is what creates karma, then carried out by body and speech, carried out by the servants of the mind. So this is why, because the mind is so intricate and the mind is so powerful and the mind is happening every millisecond, it's impossible to start to control the mind first. We've got this big lumbering bag of bones here that does the wishes of our mind every second. So at least harness the energy of the body and speech. At least harness the energy of the servants of the mind. At least begin to control the body and speech. I mean, if we're all Buddhists, we've heard this from the second we became a Buddhist. But it's somehow only starting to dawn on me how profound it is, you know. It just sounds so boring, control your body and speech, you know. And some of us have very uncontrolled body and speech. It's a real struggle. I remember one time, I always get into trouble. I'm always a troublemaker, have been. I'm trying to be good now, I'm old now, but still making trouble, can't help it. So anyway, I always used to fight with people and that kind of thing. But I meant well, you know. I meant well. So I remember this time I was complaining with self-pity to Lama Yeshe about how terrible I was. And he was just always, the way Lama said things was so mind-bogglingly simple. He just kind of always just sort of threw off these words that kind of blew my mind. It was like kind of just like a revelation every time, you know. And he said, "There's nothing wrong with your heart, dear. It's just your behavior." Somehow that was so profound for me, I can't tell you. It was like a revelation. Because you know when you're self-piteous, you think, I am terrible. So I was just telling him I was terrible. And he said, no, nothing wrong with your heart, just your behavior. I can't describe how powerful that was. It so helped me. It kind of was a relief, you know. Just control my behavior. Well, I'm still trying. So why then is Buddha exhorting us to control our behavior, which is your body and speech, which means he's exhorting us not to kill and steal and jump on the wrong partner. At the very least, just three of the body. Haven't mentioned the speech yet. Because they're actions driven by anger or attachment that will leave seeds in my mind. And because they're the heaviest ones, they will ripen as the future as my incredible suffering. And you know what? I don't want suffering. It's just kind of clear, you know. But that's why we've got to think of karma in this way. It's like self-respect. It's not punishment, not reward, and it's not selfish. It's necessary, fundamental starting point in all practice. The next four is speech. And we might not go around raping and killing too many people, that's clear. But we are really good at misusing our speech. In fact, we're outrageous at misusing our speech, you know. Let's look at this. And then I think I want to also do a meditation from time to time called Blessing the Speech. I mentioned that. Do you have it in your prayer books? Do we have it in our prayer books? It'll be there. We'll find it later at some point. It's okay. We have it, Tashi? Blessing the Speech? Oh, good. Oh, I put it in there, did I? Oh, Lama Zopas. Okay, fine. Okay, we'll do that later. Let's look at speech, okay? Let's look at our speech. This is something I think in families, in organizations, in Buddhist centers, this is the one that destroys. I don't hear of many Buddhist centers where people kill or rape, you know? I don't hear that. But you always hear about disharmony. You always hear about people bad-mouthing the director, bad-mouthing each other, the nuns bad-mouthing the monks, and the monks bad-mouthing, or the people bad-mouthing each other. You hear it all the time, all over the world. I go to many Buddhist centers. And this is our worst one. This is our worst one. We can't control our speech, which shows we can't control our mind, which shows we don't abide by the laws of karma, which shows we don't value what's in our mind, and which shows we don't realize that what we do with our speech will leave consequences to us, not to mention to others. So it really shows, this is junior school level, and here we are, Buddhists, for 20, 30, 40 years, and we still can't control our speech. So it shows how hard it is. We should be very humbled by this. I mean, my family, I always use my family as an example. I'm not trying to say we're saints. There are seven siblings. My mummy and daddy had eight babies, actually, seven daughters and then a son in like 9 years. She was quite busy, my mum. So one died, so there are seven of us, and there are six girls and a brother. So... And we're all close, and we're all very volatile, all a bit like me. The brother's not. He's the last one. I think he got suffocated by his six older sisters, I'm not sure. Anyway, whatever. But the point is what I'm getting at is we're all very close, and we're quite poor. Our mother sent us to the most fancy Catholic convent. I joke and say she still owes the bills 70 years later or something. Never mind. But the point is, we were very volatile and we were very poor, so we had to share beds. So, I mean, just having seven little human beings, all close in age, I mean, from the time there were seven of us, it's kind of volatile energy. And my mother and father fought a lot and there were lots of dramas in the family. So it was really intense. So all these human beings all mixed together. Speech is what you mainly do. Speech is so powerful. Exploding, shouting at each other, yelling. So then we all left home gradually and good friends and we all did our own different lives and we'd come home for Christmas. Of course, you'd fight. We'd talk about things because families pour out of their mouth their feelings. And then you get hurt because the other person doesn't agree with you and then you fight. This is so normal. So at some point, somehow we stayed together. We didn't break into there's no schism in our family. But, you know, if you talk, and then when you talk to each other on the phone, well, Julie did this, and then Mary did that, and Polly said this, and Janet said that. Everybody talks to each other about everybody. So everybody believes whatever they've said. We all believe what people tell us. We all believe what people tell us. So there's disharmony. Disharmony is inevitable. I mean, I hear schisms in families, sometimes into three groups. Because it's speech. It's speech, you know. So this last 20 years, maybe more, somehow this unspoken agreement. We never talk about things that we disagree with when we're together and we have lots of different views and we often come together, you know, we often the family meet. And we never say bad things about each other to each other behind backs. And I'm not saying we're all saints, but I can't tell you the profound difference in the family. There's now genuine harmony. There's a sweetness. We even rejoice in each other's qualities to each other. But that it takes effort, you know. It's incredible. It's incredible, the difference. It's incredible. I can't describe. People I know among Buddhists who never badmouth other people, they are rare jewels, I tell you. Some people I know, I can think of one at least. He never, never, I've known him for 45 years, 43 years. He has never, I've never heard him badmouth anybody. And if you do badmouth, he just listens. He doesn't say anything. And you tend, because people don't agree with you, people don't say anything, you think they agree with you. So he just listens, you know. But he never badmouths. That's an incredible quality. It's a special quality. I go to so many of Lama Zopa centers, you know. Over the years, probably gone to about half of them, maybe 70 of them. And it's exactly the same everywhere. Exactly the same. Because we're all human. We all want to be loved. We all want to be happy. We all don't like, you know, we all don't get hurt by each other. And we all can't hold it ourselves because we haven't practiced strong enough. So we have to vomit it out our mouths to anybody who'll listen, you know. And then, of course, we believe, we know we've got opinions, but we believe we're right. We believe we're right. We believe we're right. So we just stay stuck in our opinions. And then we repeat them to other people. Lama Zopa, there was this terrible schism in the FPMT in the late 70s, early 80s, and it was a big centre in England, and I was there at the time. Terrible schism. It was like war zone, I can't tell you. And Lama Zopa told us at the time, this is the result of breaking our third root tantric vow. Speaking the faults, as Lama Zopa puts it, speaking the faults of our Vajra brothers and sisters. So if you look in the world, the disharmony everywhere, many wars just become speech from past karma, families, organizations. It's speech. It's speech, you know. It's something so profound, actually. Not even body, not even harming. I mean, our family, we don't punch each other. We don't kind of rape or kill. It's just speech. In Buddhist centers, we don't rape and steal from each other, kill each other, rape each other, steal each other's boyfriends. Occasionally that might happen. It's mostly speech. But look at the effort. Look when we're feeling hurt. Look in my relationship with Ron. And I'm so hurt because he was really mean to me. Look at how this is so strong in all of us. The first thing we are doing is frantically trying to find someone to talk to. I'm not being mean about it. This is how we are. Because we don't know how to handle our own feelings. We just don't know how. So we have to. And that's good. It's okay. We need to talk to each other. But we've got to at least choose somebody we can trust. So if you have a bad time in the center or have a bad time in your relationship, get a good therapist. I agree. Find a person, but you've got to find a person you trust who you know won't gossip behind their back and whom you can trust to help you sort out your feelings. But what we do is I go to my first person who's going to speak to me and I pour out my feelings about Ron, tell one of my sisters. Then she tells another sister. Then she tells mum. Before you know it, you know, there's this drama because we don't even know how to hold our own emotions and work with them. This is why going to high school, dealing with our mind is so advanced. Having the ability and the courage and the discipline to understand our mind and work with it and be our own therapist and not have to pour everything out our mouth is pretty profound practice, I tell you. That's why learning to control our body and speech first. And if we've got nun's vows, bodhisattva vows, tantric vows, you know, it's all covered. It's all there. We break at various levels. And we just do it casually. Everybody just does it. We all do it naturally. And we wonder why we have problems, you know. This is speech, people. You can get arrested for stealing €5. You won't get arrested for bad-mouthing a friend. That shows that we don't even value speech, you know. We think I'm allowed to say what I'm allowed to say what I like. So the thing is here, there are two things that point about karma. The obvious one, this obvious first level of practices, the three of not killing and stealing and bad and sexual misconduct, and the next four, bad mouthing behind backs, lying, rabbiting on, blur blur about nothing, and abusive speech. There's four. These are all actions that specifically first harm others. But the Buddha's point here, with all the one about karma, is to get this recognition that what I do will harm me. So forget even here the harm we do to others. All look at what the harm we do to ourselves. I mean, this is very obvious with speech. We tend to think, well, if no one hears what I say, it doesn't matter. We think like this. That's insane. Let's say you're at home on your own and nobody hears you speak, but you're angry and you're shouting at the iPad when you read the news, you shout at the television, you're cursing the next door neighbor because they're too noisy. By the end of the day, who is exhausted? You. Whom have you harmed? You. And if everything you think and do and say produces seeds in your mind and produces the person you become, you are producing a very unhappy, neurotic, berserk, uncontrolled person. It is so clear and evident. This is the law of karma. Don't think it's mystical. It's logical. It's evident, you know. We harm ourselves. So I can see that too over the years, if I'm with my family or with the Buddhist centers. When you first decide to not say those bad words, and that's a struggle, because you feel you have to say it. Then you start to really work on your mind, the anger and the hurt inside your mind that drive the words. Then when you start to work on that and you eventually let go of it, then you are peaceful. Then you are peaceful. You are peaceful. So just controlling your speech but not controlling your mind, you'll go mad. But at least if you control your speech, and some people are like that. Some people have good behavior. But they don't work on their mind, they go crazy. But at least you're not harming others. With me and my actions, I harmed others and myself. If you don't badmouth, you just harm yourself, which is better than nothing. But we've got to first control the speech, then do the real job of working on our mind, working with our own neuroses, owning our own anger, owning our own hurt. Even if the person was wrong, that's never the issue here. We're all determined to say that, oh, I'm allowed to be angry because Ron did harm me. That's Ron's problem. This is why it's so hard. This is so intense. It's so kind of accountable. It's so grown up. Ron might have been mean to me. That's his problem. What's my problem? Mine's the anger. This is really hard practice. It's really, really, really hard practice. But this is the fundamentals of what Buddha's saying. And the thing is with Buddha, because he's not a creator, he didn't invent all this stuff. He doesn't have copyright on it. This is common sense. We all agree with him. It's common sense. He just points it out. He's very good at it, you know. This is the basis of ethics in Buddhism, for your sake. And then for the sake of others. As Lama Zopa says, if you stop killing, stop lying, stop stealing, you benefit yourself, no question. But guess what? All the rats and cockroaches will be happy. They'll have a party because you leave them in peace. We've got to understand the logic of this. Not just, oh, yeah, be a nice person because someone said. No. Quarter to 11. Okay, 10:30 to 11. What time do we start? 9:30. So we'll have a break in a minute, but ask questions now about all this. Just a little bit about karma. Ask questions. Please. Questions. Any questions? Yeah.
Visto che non abbiamo molta consapevolezza del nostro attaccamento di come ci pervade.
Since we don't have enough understanding.
Since we don't what?
We don't have enough awareness about our attachment and how it pervades ourselves.
That's right.
And you said earlier that even some good things that we do are actually driven by attachment.
All the things we do that are good are driven by attachment. Is there until we're very highly realized, yes.
Okay. And so how is this driven by, does it work as a motivation?
Attachment is our motivation, yeah, precisely. Attachment is our main motivation. Hearing this is initially very shocking because we don't give it this status in our ordinary world. Because attachment is so pervasive and so natural, we just call it normal and don't call it negative. It's very depressing to hear it's negative or, you know, but this is how it is. We want to be really analytical and careful about it. So then?
So does it mean that everything we do that we think is good is actually from the point of view of the...
Yeah, much, yes, yes. Not it's very nuanced and it's very subtle and very sophisticated how it all works. But in general, if the motivation is mainly attachment, then the action is mainly negative. I mean, you can say there's good. We never do it. If we did it totally with attachment, you would be a vampire. You would be a total monster. You would be what the world calls a psychopath. So we can see we're not that bad. But why is because we do have some virtue. There is some virtue there, and that tempers our attachment. That's why we have to become familiar with our minds. But the more we understand attachment in the way the Buddha, you know, the way the lamas talk, the more shocking it sounds at how primordially deep it is. So in other words, you know, I can be kind to Ron. I will be kind to Ron. But right now it's because I have lots of attachment for Ron. And I have got, naturally it's easy to be kind to a person you're attached to because he looks at me with loving eyes and he is kind back. So it's easy to be kind. Look, okay, if you forget Ron, look at your baby. mothers are attached to their babies. You see, this always sounds shocking for our culture because it sounds like it's criticizing people. But this is Buddha's analysis of the universe, you know. So attachment is the main drive for a mother. That baby looks the most divine baby she's ever seen. Isn't it true for mothers? I mean, I'm not a mother. But, you know, you can see a picture of 1,000 babies and you'll recognize your baby in a second because they look so sublime and so divine, because that's attachment. Attachment makes the object look very beautiful. So it's attachment in the mind of the mother that makes the baby look so beautiful. So alongside that attachment is there is lots and lots of love. Love is, may you be happy. It's my job to make you happy. Every second she's thinking about the baby and her job to make the baby happy. That is called love. But look at this. You know, a normal, ordinary person, not a saint or anything, you've got lots of attachment and you have some love. So as long as your baby behaves nicely and goes to bed early and sleeps lots of times and doesn't do too much caca, then you won't get unhappy, will you? You'll be happy and you'll always love your baby. But why do you think mothers get stressed? Because attachment is getting what it doesn't want all the time. The baby cries too often. The baby shits in its nappies too often. The baby won't sleep. So what happens? Aversion arises. It's called aversion. It's called anger. And then eventually some people want to kill their babies and they completely have an exhaustion and a mental breakdown because they can't cope. That's because we have attachment and aversion. If you didn't have attachment and aversion, you would never get upset with a crying baby. That's what bodhisattvas are like because there's no attachment. So it's natural for us, but then we understand its role in our lives. So as long as the other person behaves nicely, you won't notice your attachment. Are you seeing my point? Does it make sense? So it's very depressing to hear this because it sounds like really brutal, but this is the Buddha's analysis. You know, Lama Zopa says, junior school and high school, the wisdom wing is like, if that's the first level of realization is called renunciation. It's called you renounce, you give up suffering, and you've got to know the three kinds. We're just talking the first kind here, and its causes. Karma and neuroses. So when you've got renunciation, Lama Zopa, I mean genuine realization of renunciation, as Lama Zopa says, when you've got renunciation, just the thought of another moment of attachment is so repulsive, it's like being in a septic tank. Now that's like high, okay? So we just have to keep looking, that's all. And be very humbled by this. Do you understand? That's right. It's an eye-opener, isn't it? That's right. But totally rejoice in our good qualities. Don't be depressed. We should be happy to notice how our virtue is there and be delighting in our virtue, but realize we can have much more power, much more goodness, and we should be excited by the thought of that rather than dragged down by it. Do you understand? Okay. Who else? People. Yeah. And this is why when we get more into the bodhisattva path, this is why Rinpoche never, never, never stops getting us to see there are ways of redeeming our crazy lives by adding virtue into the mix as our motive, consciously articulating positive motivations. We have to do it consciously because it doesn't come naturally. And that is so powerful. Whether before we eat our food, we think of wanting to help others. Anything like that, as soon as you have even one virtuous thought, that it still will be attachment when you eat the food, but you just put a powerful virtue into the mix and that begins to change the character of the actions we do. It's very easy to do that. We have to remember. That's the bodhisattva approach. Do you understand? Yeah. Someone else? Yep.
As you said, karma means action, originally in Sanskrit. And I'm always a bit confused about whether when we refer to karma in Buddhist teachings, whether karma refers plainly to action or past action, or is it the stream of all action?
Okay, I think the way the word is used, we say, oh, it's karma. It's a shorthand for saying it's the law of cause and effect. Everything it's the law of cause and effect when it comes to people, sentient beings and their experiences. You understand? So botany is the name of the law that runs gardens. Would you agree? So karma is the shorthand we use. It's the law of cause and effect that runs people's experiences and happiness and suffering. So the word karma itself means action. And if you want to really start drive, dig deep into it, like we began before, we look into the components of an action, what determines whether an action is negative or positive. And I haven't finished what I said before. The thing to understand in the second, the first is the object, a mouse. The second is the intention to kill, and then the motivation that impels the action. We use the word intention to refer to the motivation, but just analyzing it here. Intention is the real meaning of the word karma. In other words, it's mental action. And without mental action, the body and speech might do things, but you can't really say there's karma on the mind because the mind wasn't involved, technically speaking.
So intention is the real meaning of the word
karma, yeah. I mean, karma is also created by body and speech, but it has to, the action of body and speech has to be driven by a mental state. Do you understand?
I just want to close that, just ask one other question about that terrain. So would the object be to derive from the teaching a higher sense of perception about the stream of
what's that word you said, this one?
A higher sense of perception.
About?
About, or enabling, the teachings ideally would enable us to see the stream of actions or intentions more clearly.
Oh, okay, well, like, okay, it's like any body of knowledge, isn't it? You just see a garden out there, you don't know, you know a rose and you can see a herb, but you can learn botany, you can learn the intricacies of the law that help you understand why what is there and, crucially, can help you understand what to do to produce the garden of the future. The karma is the same. Exactly the same. And as you, first intellectual knowledge, and then as you get, when you get single point of concentration and you get clairvoyance, which is a natural consequence of getting, you know, skill in meditation, you will be able to have more power with karma and see the past and the future and be more sophisticated in your ability to practice. And indeed, crucially, in your ability to help others. I mean, there's always a story I tell about Lama Yeshe at Kopan Monastery. Our friend Harry was trying to help one of the monks there who was very sick. And he'd found a doctor to help. And Harry happened to tell Lama Yeshe he'd found this doctor. And Lama just said to Harry, it's okay, he doesn't need a doctor. Let it be. So Harry trusted Lama, it's his guru. So Harry didn't do anything. So he noticed the monk got getting sicker and sicker. And eventually he went up to the mountains. He was a Sherpa. And eventually he died. Now that sounds like Lama Yeshe was very cruel and didn't care how to help this monk. Do you understand? But Lama Lundup, the abbot, explained to Harry, well, Lama, because of his clairvoyance, and we've got to remember, clairvoyance is this natural consequence of accomplishing karma abiding. It's natural. We've had clairvoyance in countless lives, Buddha says. This is something the Hindus, discovered well before the Buddha. Because the subtle level of consciousness can cognize phenomena that are subtle, which is the past, the future, and the minds of others. And the Buddha says that you really can't begin to help until you've got clairvoyance. So there's Lama with clairvoyance and bodhicitta and wisdom. So he can see very clearly the exact actions that this monk did in whatever lifetime in the past that is now the result, resulting in his present suffering. He can also see, Lama Lundup told Harry, that if the monk had gotten better, if he'd got the doctor and gotten better, his life would have been great. But he wouldn't have finished that heavy negative karma, and next life much, much worse. Whereas by having the sickness, he completed the karma, he died very peacefully, next life fantastic. Now, who's got that kind of wisdom? But that's the wisdom we must get if we really want to help others. You with me? So we use whatever wisdom we've got. Do the best we can, you know. Any other questions, people? Yes, Kira. I'll go. Yes, darling, go. You go. Say your name when you talk so we all know each other. What's your name?
Rita.
Rita. Good, Rita.
Yesterday when you said, no, we have to reinforce, we have to improve our good quality, okay? And I remember what you said yesterday, that in our daily life, we see so many images, kind of millions, trillions of images that we have in our consciousness.
E questo ci crea.
And this creates a lot of confusion between us, between reality and what actually how we perceive these different images, the pictures.
So you mean when you say the pictures, you mean all the viewpoints in our mind about the outside world?
Riguardo a quello che noi percepiamo.
Sì, praticamente questo, come dicevi tu, questo spaccatura fra la realtà, quella che
so
è.
So that kind of not. Between the reality and what we
see, reality. Yeah, there's a big disconnect, yes.
Okay.
Because of these neurotic states of mind. Yes, yes.
Allora, per sostenere la parte meritevole, quale può essere un modo per fermare questa entrata di fotografie?
So in order to support the positive state of mind, how we can protect ourselves from making all this images coming in.
We can't stop them because they're all, like I said before, okay, there's two ways our mind works. Two ways, it seems to me, speaking colloquially, there's two main ways that our mind works. One is, as Geshe Tashi in London said, it's like all day we're shooting a movie every second. Everything we see and experience with our senses and with our mind, without awareness, is stored as images in our mind. Lama Zopa said it's like taking photos all day. There's no qualitative thing about it. It's just images, countless trillions, and this is from countless past lifetimes. So there's one thing. Then the other one is the more qualitative way the mind processes things, and that's called karma. That's based on negative states, positive states, and there's all this. So there's this uncontrolled series of images popping up, then there's these uncontrolled thoughts coming, which are opinions about things. But many of these images, some people talk about having very scary images, terrifying images. They have no idea why they have them. That's all old stuff from past lives. People can go crazy with that. So there's that level of stuff. And I don't know whether you're talking about that level of stuff or weird stuff that comes in our dreams. Dreams is just another way to show what's in our mind, you know, images. There's the images and stuff that we don't even understand. But then there are the thoughts that are happening every millisecond. And that's like complete chaos, totally berserk, uncontrolled thoughts. This is the natural way the mind is because we've never worked on the mind. So it's a pretty intense thing to have to learn to live with. And the interesting point is, they say in the texts, when you start, even when how they describe the nine stages of concentration in the texts, they even say one of the signs of success at the first of these nine stages is that you think your mind's getting more berserk. But your mind isn't getting more berserk. We're now noticing our mind. Our mind has been like this all the time. But because in our normal life, when from the time you wake up until the time you go to sleep, we're totally preoccupied by the outside. We don't pay attention to here until it's screaming, until there's rage or jealousy or we're going crazy. Then we notice. But it's happening all the time, but we never pay attention. So then when we start to pay attention, it's very scary. You think, where has all this come from? But that's why we've got to have courage. And no, you can't just make it go away overnight. The power of it is so intense from a long, many, many lifetimes. Forget just this lifetime. So part of the thing is we've got to have the courage to learn to live with all this crazy stuff, not identify with it. Even if we're understanding the teachings by realizing it isn't who I really am. It's just old images. It's old thoughts. And we have to learn this courage to begin to step away from it and observe it all. Like you've got all these crazy roommates next door. They're not going to leave. These crazy guys getting drunk every day, shouting and yelling and playing their music, but they're in your head. And we've got to learn to live with these and know they're not who I really am. They don't define me. And slowly, slowly, I can learn to control them. This is why we go mad. And that's why when people start to meditate, all these ridiculous misconceptions about the benefit of meditating, because we often think that meditation is an alternative to a pill. We only start to meditate when things go crazy, when Ron wants to kill me, when we're nearly going mad. And then all we think is that meditation is to make it all go away. All these misconceptions. So there's no courage there, and we just go crazier, trying to live in avoidance. And that's why at least we have to put us, before you can even argue, before we even start to control our body and speech, we've got to really control our environment. If I can't cope with Ron, if really it is that difficult, I've got to leave Ron. Don't blame Ron. If work is so crazy you can't cope, if the traffic on the road is so distressing, then don't drive. Don't go to work. The very first step, at least protect ourselves by giving ourselves a reasonable environment so we can kind of get some sanity. Then we can begin to control our body and speech. Then we can begin to control our mind and get real courage. Do you understand? It's a slow, slow, gradual process. But the crucial one is to know from the Buddha's teachings that this stuff is not at the core of our being. There is logic to it. It's just old stuff from the past. And to learn to try to identify our good qualities, try to support ourselves in being stable, and learn to live with all these crazy voices, live with these crazy roommates. This is not easy. I mean, this is not easy. But we have to. This is no choice. It's not going to go away overnight. Do you understand? And actually, a real sign of progress in your practice can be that you could be feeling a lot worse. I mean, one of our friends, an Australian monk, Roger, not Lama Zopas Roger, another one, he's been in meditative like 35 years, I forget, professional, 3 years, 4 year retreats, you know? And one time, this is like 30 years ago, 20 years ago, he told me, at some point after one of his many long retreats, he thought he was going crazy. Out of his brain with rage and arrogance, he really was uncontrolled. Years of retreat. You'd think by then you think you're a saint already, you know? But he was going crazy. He was very distressed. And he went to Lama Zopa. And Lama Zopa just laughed and laughed and said, fantastic. The dirt has to come out. The dirt has to come out. The dirt has to come out. And when we understand that it's a sign of progress, we can be courageous. This is a major part of practice, I tell you. The idea that as soon as you start to meditate, you become all holy and wonderful is like a load of rubbish. Do you understand? Yes? Good, darling. Let's have a break. It's half an hour will do. Go and have a cup of tea or a biscuit or something, whatever. And then, yeah, good, then see you in half an hour. Thank you. Yo, Juana, come see me. I'm going to stay here for a minute. You just go. Do what you like. We're done. We're ready.